We take just a few minutes as we introduce Psalms every week and just talk in a generic way about the Psalms, and then so difficult to know how to cover 150 chapters in 9 classes. It's a little bit, you do the math. Is that 15 classes per 15 chapters per class or something like that? And so I knew when we started we wouldn't be able to cover them in detail at all. And so we spent 2 weeks just talking about the nature of Psalms and when they were written, who wrote them and everything. And then for the last several weeks, we've been just taking the first few minutes talking in a generic way about the Psalms, and then more specifically, just looking at Dan's favorite verses. I don't know if that's any help to you. There have been some real encouraging comments that you've said about some of the things that we've said as we've looked at these Psalms, and I appreciate all those comments and everything. But let me just point out the fact that we'll look at one of those this morning, that they are historical Psalms. Historical Psalms. And we'll look at one of them. That might help you understand what I'm talking about when I say that. But you know these verses in the Scriptures, do you not? Now, all these things happen unto them for, you know that word? Examples. And they're written for our admonition. Upon whom have come, the old King James says, the ends of the world. That's 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11. I want you to think about what that verse says. Paul's writing the church at Corinth, talking to them about their daily life, about everything that was happening in the church there. They've got immorality in the church. They've got brethren bickering back and forth with each other, murmuring once against another. How are you going to address that, Paul? He said, let me tell you some Bible stories. Several years ago, I sat back and tried to analyze the preaching of the church back at a time when the church was really growing rapidly. Many of you are that age, and if you were in the church at that time, you can remember the kinds of preaching there was. They told Bible stories. And they then made application of these Bible stories. We have gotten a long way away from that. We're not as knowledgeable about the Bible as we used to be. In fact, several years ago, and this may have happened, if not, it's a great preacher story. Wow. That in a small town in Texas, they could not find a Bible for the man to put his hands on to swear in that he's going to tell the truth. And so they found a member of the church and they put their hands on him because they said he's a walking Bible. You know, I've known some people that had that term or another. I had a great uncle that it said he was a walking Bible. He could quote every verse in the Bible. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's true. It'd been right. It'd be good. It'd been wonderfully right if he could have done it. But I doubt that it was true, but he knew the Bible that way. He wasn't a preacher by any means. This man just sat down and read the Bible. That's what folks used to do. Sit around the open fireplace sometime with a kerosene lantern, hurricane lamp for those of you in Florida, and they just read the Bible. And that's how they knew the Bible. In Bible classes, and the congregation I grew up in, we rarely ever had full-time preaching until I was 9, 10, 11 years of age. You know, that age of my life, they'd get up and they'd read them. On Sunday morning, they'd have Bible classes. And I've been in classes where somebody would read a verse. They said, that verse is talking about Jesus. All right, read the next verse. They'd read the next verse and they said, that verse is talking about Jesus. Now let's read the next verse. And it wasn't a lot of deep Bible knowledge, but we knew the Bible just because of the very nature of preaching. And so I quoted 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11. What about Romans chapter 15? Whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning. That's amazing what we're talking about. These Old Testament stories. He wasn't talking about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John whenever he said that. They were written. They were written for our learning, that we, through the patience and the comfort of the Scriptures, there's your whole sermon right there, the comfort of the Scriptures. And that's what Psalms is in many respects, and I hope that's what we're trying to, what's happening as we look at some of Dan's favorite verses in the Psalms, is just the comfort of the Scriptures. But they are historical Psalms, and we hurt ourselves by not knowing Bible history like we used to. When people come to me for counseling, what I investigate first in my head is not the books about psychology and, you know, how to be successful in life and things of that nature. First thing that comes to my mind is what Bible story has application to the very thing we're talking about. I believe that's so important for us to be able to have that concept. And so there are those historical Psalms, and they're important to us. And we'll be looking, you know, at some of those Psalms. In fact, there are about maybe three Psalms that are almost entirely historical. And we'll see that as we look at the Psalms. I wanted to get to chapter 71, 72, whatever that verse is. That now I'm an old man, let me live a little bit longer so I can tell the next generation about you. But I want us to back up. We got through Psalm 70. I want us to back up a little bit and look at some of the verses we didn't have time to look at last week. I want us to look, first of all, at a verse that has really, really helped me, particularly, as I've grown in my faith and in my relationship to God. Look at Psalm 68. Psalm 68. The psalm begins, "Let God arise, let his enemies be scattered. Let those who hate him flee before him. As smoke is driven away, so drive them away. As wax melts before the fire, so let the wicked perish at the presence of God. Let the righteous be glad. Yea, let them rejoice before God. Yea, let them rejoice exceedingly." We need to understand that whenever we see people reaping what they sow, there ought to be a degree of satisfaction in relationship to that. I think that's what this verse is all about. It's a reminder of the justice of God. What got you upset? Injustice? Somebody commits a crime and it's unbelievable what happens to them, and they just get away with it. You just think about how that happens. But when there is justice, there is a degree of joy that comes from knowing that God is faithful, that whatever God is not mocked, whatever a man sows, that shall he also reap. Now, when I see that happen, what ought to be my response? Well, I sure am sorry for them. Well, I'm sorry that they're hurting, but, you know, is this verse in the Bible? They've made their bed, let them sleep in it. I don't think that verse is in the Bible. But isn't that a truth? He got just what was coming to him. And so you've got this verse, and it's the preamble to a verse that I want to point out to every widow that's here. We've got several widows in this church. We've got several who someday may be widows. And here's a verse, and I remember who showed me this verse. I mean, I'd read it. You know what I'm talking about? You've read the verse. You know it's in the Bible. I must have read that sometime, because I've read the Bible through X number of times. You know, I know I've read that. But it's Bill Boyd. Remember Bill Boyd? Here is the verse that we ought to think about in relationship to widows and in relationship to our single people in the church. Relationship to single moms, those who are lonely, who don't have support. Just every every individual that is characterized by loneliness, God put some verses in the Bible especially for you, and then more especially perhaps for the rest of us. Sing to God, verse 4, 68:4. Sing to God, sing praises to His name, extol Him who rises on the cloud by His name Yah, that's Yahweh, Jehovah, by His name Jehovah, and rejoice before Him. Here is what He is. God is a Father of the fatherless and a defender of widows. That God is God in His holy habitations. Widows, you need to hear these verses. God is a defender of the widows in His holy habitations. I know you may sit and feel like you're all by yourself, you know, divorced and everything, and you just wish there's somebody in your life. You're that young lady who, you know, the time she was 21, 22 years of age, she says, I'm 2/3 married. You know, I picked out the preacher, I picked out the ring, all I need to do is find the man, you know. And so it doesn't happen. And we've seen that happen. I've known of it happening in this church. Just can't find anybody. It does life circumstances. And then there are those widows. And how interesting it is that as you look at the church and look at the day, the time of the year, many women in this church became widows. It's at the end of the year. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? And so here we are right at that time, the end of the year, and the anniversary of the death of that person. You know, you who are widows, you understand what I'm talking about. And so here's God. He's a defender of widows. And then, this is the verse Bill Boyd pointed out to me, God sets the solitary in families. Hello. The church, of the living God, 1 Timothy chapter 3, is the family of God. What does that say about the rest of us? What does that say about us being godly people? God's in His holy habitation, and here we are on this earth. What does that say about our place in being the hands and the arms of God and having the homes for those who are widows? He sets the solitary in families. He brings out those who are bound into prosperity, but the rebellious dwell in a holy land. I love that. Now think about the counterpart to this verse. Pure and undefiled religion is to eat the Lord's Supper every Sunday without fail. Pure and undefiled religion is. You want to fill in that verse? You know what it is? Yeah. Pure and undefiled religion is to visit the fatherless and widows. Hey, that's what we just read. He's a father to the fatherless and a defender of widows. And He says to those of us who are His children, look, you've got an obligation. God puts the solitary in families, and pure and undefiled religion is how you treat the solitaries. Isn't that amazing? You want to talk about the judgment day? Those on the right hand and those on the left hand? And I know there's more involved in it than the things found in Matthew, in that story in Matthew chapter 25. But He says to those on His right hand, and then the contrary-wise to those on the left hand, I was sick. I was in prison. I was hungry. I was thirsty. I was naked. And You saw my need and You ministered to my needs. When, Lord? When did we ever see you in that situation? And he says, as oft as you did it to one of these, the least of my brethren. You know, talk about people often overlooked in the church. And things, there's not much in a situation much sadder than a widow in the church whose husband used to be an elder or used to be a preacher. You know why? You know what their life is? Husband's been an elder in the church 20, 25 years. And they've stood side by side supporting their husband and everything. And their whole life was what was wrapped up in the church. You know, they were a part of the church. And now all of a sudden they're no longer a part of the church because their husbands died. And they're just outside the loop. And the very thing that had preoccupied their life all of those years, if you're not careful, it's gone. Same thing about a preacher's wife. You know, think about the importance of a preacher's wife. I believe the making of every every good and godly preacher that I have known has been his wife. I can hardly think of a single exception about this. And she's so involved in the church, and she's seen her husband throughout all of the trials that she's had and everything, and now all of a sudden her life is ended because her husband's died. But that's not just true of elder's wife and preacher's wife. Pure and undefiled religion is to make sure that we are the hands of God and that we are the eyes of God. And we are the ones who minister to God in all of these things. Seems like I looked at another verse or two here, but let's look at that historical psalm. I've looked at 71. I've lost my historical psalm. Look at 83. Here's one of those historical psalms. I've got a heading underneath this. I don't know if you have headings underneath your psalms. This one says some man's put this in here. A prayer to frustrate conspiracy against Israel. If we're the Israel of God, pray this prayer. Do not keep silent, O God. Do not hold your peace. Do not be still. For behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their heads. They've taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones. They've said, come, and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more. They have consulted together with one consent. They formed a conspiracy against you, the tents of Edom, the Ishmaelites, the Moabites, the Hagrites, Gebal, Ammon, Amalek, the Philistines with the inhabitants of Tyre. Assyria has joined with them. They have helped the children of Lot. That's Moab and Ammon. And the word Selah likely means pause. Think about it. And that's about where we stop. When the adversity, when troubles surround us and we arrive at this point and there's just, you know, not a lot of good things happening in the life of us, we're pretty good at talking about what's happening. But then, listen to how the psalmist deals with them. Deal with them as with Midia, as with Sisera. Who's Sisera? I mean, here the psalmist is. I don't know whether it's David or not. But here's Sisera. Who's Sisera? Well, you remember the period of the judges? You remember the female judge, the woman judge? You remember her name? That's Deborah. You remember who helped her to destroy the enemy against God? Was it Barak or Balak? Barak, I guess it was. And you've got this great, great battle going on. And Sisera is put to flight. God works with Barak and his army destroys the Midianites. Except for Sisera. He's the captain of the army. And he's fleeing for his life. And he comes to the tent of a lady by the name of Jael, the wife of Heber. And she says, would you like something to eat? And so she stops, gives shelter to him. He stops, gives shelter. He gives her, she gives him shelter. And when nightfall comes, she sneaks into the tent where he is asleep, takes a tent stake, and drives it through the side of his head into the ground. Great enemy of God's people defeated by a woman. Isn't that amazing? Now there's a sequel to that story. And that is, the next night, Jael said to Heber, honey, you want something to eat before you go to bed? That's not in the Bible, but when I become and read those Bible stories, I think about how that had to impact their marriage. I mean, he looked, I guarantee you, he looked at that woman differently from the way he looked at her 2 days before and everything. But God says, wait a minute, you need to know that story. But if Israel needed to know that story, don't we? Deliverance arises not from the obvious place. So many times it comes from the inobvious place, from places you'd never expect it. There's David with his slingshot. Hello? What are you going to do? That's that giant over there. And here's this little shepherd boy comes out there. And before long, he's got Goliath's sword and he's chopping the head off of Goliath. Surprise, surprise, not just to Goliath, but to all of God's people. Why is that story in the Bible? Why is this story in the Bible about Sisera? What about this story of the Midianites? And he says, as with Jabin at the brook of Kishon, who perished at Endor, who became his refuge on the earth, make their nobles like Oreb and like Zeb, yes, and all the princes like Zeba and Zalmunna, who said, let us take for ourselves the pastures of God for possession. O God, make them like a whirling dust, just a dust storm. Let them be confounded, verse 17, and dismayed forever. Yes, let them be put to shame and perish, that they may know that you, whose name alone is Jehovah, are the Most High over all of this earth. How do you use the Old Testament? What are these stories in the Bible all about? And so, we listen to Dan preach, Josh preach, or David preach, and all of a sudden we're telling a story. And we ought to listen like that's like the first time we ever heard it. If you want Bible stories to come alive, listen to it like you've never heard it. And it'll change who you are when you're trying to read the Bible through. When you're studying the just read it like you've never, ever, ever, ever heard it. I love to tell the stories for the old story. For those who know it best, the rest of that phrase, Betty Sanders about ready to mouth it, seem hungering and thirsting to hear it like the rest. I've watched older preachers back when I was a younger preacher, and some younger guy would be up preaching, and I'd watch Brother Camp, Brother Nichols, some of those older preachers, and they're sitting there just like this, listening as hard as they can. And I thought, You know 10 times more about that story than that young guy up there. Seemed hungering and thirsting to hear it like the rest. That's why these historical psalms are in the Bible. Look at Psalms 90. We may go back and look at another historical psalm in just a minute. Look at Psalms 90. Lord, you have been our dwelling place. Is that right? Are those just words? Are these words that you can, you are my habitation, dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You have that concept of God? What was there before there was the first day of creation? How far back can you go? Before Genesis 1, how far back do you go that direction? Forever. Infinite. When this world is no more and there's no longer a sun to make us have 24-hour days, what's going to be? Eternity. From everlasting to everlasting, you're God. That needs to be at the core of every one of us. Moses says, what shall I tell them your name is when I go down to the land of Egypt? You tell them, I am. That's my name. The I am. I am that I am. I am who I am. I am what I am. I am. And so here's this eternity, and the I am is there. And now here we are in this period of time from that eternity reaching over to this other eternity. And guess who's right here? The God that we read about here in the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament, is the same God that was back there, gracious and loving and kind and powerful and almighty, and every aspect of the eternal God. We see it in the miracles of God, those special times in the Bible. We see His providence in the lives of all of those individuals. And that's that same God. And when the world is no more and we're over in eternity, you're worried about starving to death in heaven? Isn't that amazing? Then why do we worry about things that are right here? From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. I think that is really, really a good psalm. I think it is one that will really help us. But can I show you another verse? Starting in verse 7, we have been consumed by your anger. That's His nature. And by your wrath we are terrified. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance. For all our days have passed away in your wrath. We finish our years as a sigh. And then this verse. The days of our years are 70 years. How close are you to that number? Isn't that amazing? Now, if that's true, you know what middle age is? If the days of our years are 70, the old King James says, what's middle age? What's middle age to us? 65. Isn't that about right? Are you 65 and feel like you're middle-aged? You understand what I'm talking about? Now, if you're 75, you've got enough problems in your body that you may not feel like you're middle-aged. But honestly, somebody in their 50s, mid-50s, they're middle-aged. No, they're not. You're middle-aged at 35. And so he says, the days of our years or 70 years. I thought about asking everybody to raise their hand here that's above 70, but I didn't want you to lie. So he says, the days of our years are 70. Now suppose you make it to 80. We have anybody here that's 80? Don't raise your hand, but I think I know one or two, and I know one that's mighty close to it. If by reason of strength they are 80 years, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away. That's it, folks. How close is the end? God said, and we use that expression, you're living on what kind of time? Really? Do we really think that? I'm pretty healthy for 70. I'm not pretty, but I'm healthy for 70. You understand? I'm doing pretty good. I feel good. For my age, I really, really feel good. Okay. What are the days of your years? 70. And if you make it to 80, what's that? Pain and sorrow. Was that song on Hee Haw? And where on earth did that come into my head, Pain and sorrow. I don't know if they sang a song years ago on that old TV. Some of you remember what I'm talking about, okay? The widow said had three men in her life. Ben Charlie, Ben, and Arthur. Somebody said, really? Yeah, Charlie Horse, Ben Gay, and Arthritis. I've got these three men. Isn't that the 80s? You understand what I'm talking about? And yet we live our lives as though I'm going to do that tomorrow. Why take ye thought for the tomorrow? Saying, what shall we eat or what shall we drink? That's the thing the pagans seek. Woe to you that say, today or tomorrow we'll go into the city and buy and get gain. Woe to you. Why? You do not know what will be on the morrow. That's an amazing verse. And so he says, and by reason of strength, yet they rose. Now look at verse 12. Teach us to number our days. Number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. We've got to understand the brevity of life. And who was that little boy that said, I think the reason my grandma's reading the Bible so much is she knows the final test is coming and she's cramming right before the final test. And maybe we all ought to be cramming some more just right before the final test. Go back to Psalm 68. We got to verse 5 about the sets of the solitary. Verse 7 says, O God, when you went out before your people, when you march through the wilderness, Selah, stop and think about it. Nobody's absolutely sure that's what that means. But evidently it's a musical term. Just like we have little notations in our songs, when they're projected on the screen, there are all kinds of little squares and triangles and all other kinds of stuff up there and little letters above it. And all of it's notation of the guy that's leading the singing. And some people, and the consensus is that Selah just says, when you're singing this psalm, just stop the choir And let everybody think about what you just said. You were the God in the wilderness. Now, to the Jew, what wilderness is that? It's the one that just got through the Red Sea. Just got through the Red Sea, and guess what the problem is? Got all this, we don't have anything to eat. We got this manna. Well, that happened in the wilderness, didn't it? We are sick and tired of eating this manna. That's all we've got to eat is this manna. And the Lord said, okay, I'll send you some quails. And overnight, the quails blew in until they were a cubit deep. I think it was a cubit. I forget all the details. I don't think it was 2 cubits, but the whole camp. Now, you think about 6 million people, if there were that many, how many quails that is? 18 inches of quails around an encampment where there were 1.5 million to 6 million people. That's a lot of quail. And that's a lot of them. And so the Bible says, and they ate them. And I remember as a young preacher trying to be exuberant and mixing up what my mama had said when I was growing up and mixing up what God had said, which is really important. I said, and the Bible said they ate those quails till they ran out their ears. That's what my mama said, you know. You've eaten enough if food's running out your ears. And I thought, some good brother came up and said, Brother Dan, the Bible says it came out their nostrils. I said, that's close enough, okay. But you understand? Sick to death of it. Detested it. Oh, how we miss the things. That good food like we had in the land of Egypt. Yeah, you remember? No, we don't remember slaves, but we remember those vegetables we had down there in that land. And I wish we could go back. Let's get rid of Moses and let's appoint another captain and let's head back to Egypt. That's what they said. He said, you were the God who was there in the wilderness, and stop and think about it. And then he says, when you marched through the wilderness, the earth shook. The heavens dropped rain at the presence of God. Sinai, Mount Sinai itself was moved at the presence of God, the God of Israel. You, Lord, sent a plentiful rain, whereby you confirmed your inheritance. When it was weary, your congregation dwelt in it. You, our God, provided from your goodness for the poor. The Lord gave the word. Great was the company of those who proclaim it. Kings of armies flee, they flee. Yes, she who remains at home divides your spoils. Though you lie down among the sheepfolds, you'll be like the wings of a dove covered with silver and her feathers with yellow gold. When the Almighty scattered kings in it, it was white like the snow of Zalmon. A mountain of God is the mountain of Bashan. A mountain of many peaks are the mounts of Bashan. Why do you fume with envy, you mountains of many peaks? This is the mountain which the Lord desires to dwell in. The Lord will dwell in it forever. Bashan's those mountains where the enemy was found. Why on earth, Israel, would you covet the mountains of Bashan when you have Mount Zion? When you've got Mount Sinai? When you've got the Mount of Olives? And figuratively, when you've got the Mount of Golgotha? See how to read the Psalms? And I think it's so important for us to learn how to use this book. It's the one time in the Bible where you see the heart and soul of Bible heroes. There are glimpses that you see sometimes in solitary stories. But the glimpses you see oftentimes are just our reflections on the actions of that person. Let me see if I can illustrate that, running out of time. Met a brother who obeyed the gospel in Germany when Otis Gateway at the end of the Second World War sent missionaries right in the heart of Germany, Frankfurt, Germany. Their life was almost in danger. I mean, the war was just over. And missionaries were sent into that land. And met a man who knew the missionary. His name was Otis Gatewood. I met this man in New Zealand. "How'd you come into the church?" He said, "Well, I needed some shoes." And I knew down there at the church, American Brethren had sent a lot of goods over there for the church in Frankfurt to distribute. I mean, we were destitute. And he got down there, and this American missionary was there, and he said, "I said, I need some shoes. I'm barefooted." He said, "Well, we got these shoes over here in this room. Come, let's see what we can find." And it wasn't a single pair of shoes in there that fit him. And he said, that American said to me, "What size shoes you got?" And when he told Brother Gatewood took his shoes off and gave them to Hans. And Brother Gatewood went home barefooted. That's the historical event. And if we'll read the Bible slow enough, we will be able, if we learn the details of these stories, we will be able to think about, "I really wish I had known Otis Gatewood." Some of you may have heard him preach. You've got to be pretty old to have heard that. Isn't that remarkable? But the book of Psalms says, "Here's my heart. You want to know how I live close to God? Here's what I think about." And let me encourage you to read the Psalms. Selah. Well, if I read 5 Psalms a day in a month's time, I'll be read every single one of the Psalms. No. Read the Psalm. Selah. Stop and think about it. Thank you so much for what you've listened today. We'll take up here next week.